no choice but to write, you know. There are stories that need to be told, mm-hmm. you know. During the process of creating each book, there were nights that I could not sleep. I would hear my characters calling out to me, you know. They mm-hmm. would say, get up and write. Our stories cannot sleep unless you tell them.
I'm J.R. Jameson. Today on The Facing Project, I sit down with Vietnamese poet and novelist Winfon Quy Mai, author of the international bestsellers The Mountain Sing and Dust Child, to talk about writing the American and Vietnam War from Vietnamese perspectives and how volunteering for international peace organizations has influenced how she tells stories. Stay with us. This season, I'm doing something a little different to mix up our format. I'll still share stories from past Facing projects to shine a light on specific topics and issues, but also I'll sit down for long-form interviews with business executives, best-selling authors, filmmakers, and other artists who are using their platforms to make the world a more understanding and empathetic place, asking each of them, how do we create a more empathetic world in a time when listening has decreased and each person's message is competing with millions of others? Today's guest is Dr. Winfon Quy Mai, a Vietnamese poet, filmmaker, and novelist who tells the stories of Vietnam and the American and Vietnam War from Vietnamese perspectives and sharing experiences that most Americans might have never heard before. Her first two novels, The Mountain Sing and Dust Child, became instant international bestsellers. Dr. Winfon Quy Mai, Vietnamese poet and novelist, author of the international bestsellers The Mountain Sing and Dust Child, thank you for joining me on The Facing Project.
Thank you so much, JR, for having me on your show. You said my name like a Vietnamese. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And I want to send my greetings and thanks to anyone who's listening to us.
Yes, thank you. I'm thrilled to chat with you today. I've been following your work for some time, and we share some of the same friends and professional colleagues. And so I'm thrilled for us to sit and have this conversation today. I want to actually start with your most well-known work to date, at least in the United States and internationally, too, which is your international best-selling novel, The Mountain Sing, that paints a multi-generational tale of the Tran family set against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. You were born in 1973, 2 years before the American and Vietnam War had ended, and you grew up in post-war Vietnam. Talk about why you chose to tell the story as a fictionalized novel versus a narrative nonfiction or memoir.
Thank you so much for doing research about me and my work and for this question. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the reasons why I had to write this novel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, The Mountain Sing was born out of frustration. I was quite frustrated with the ways many books written by Westerners about Vietnam and the ways many Hollywood films have portrayed Vietnam. You know, we often were seen as the war rather than a country, and Vietnamese people were often seen as the background to the Western stories. So with this novel, I wanted to reclaim the rights of Vietnamese people to tell our own story and to present Vietnam beyond the war as a country with more than 4,000 years of history and culture. So The Mountain Sing is very much about the Vietnamese storytelling tradition and the roles that women play in it. So it's told via the voices of grandmother Diệu Lan and her granddaughter Hương. So it's inspired by my own family experiences as well as the experiences of many people whom I interviewed. And it's a good question regarding why I chose to write this book as a novel rather than as a memoir or as a nonfiction book. Because I think a novel, you know, like was an easier form because, you know, I had interviewed so many people, and at one point of writing this book, I was so overwhelmed with the amount of information that I had collected. So I was thinking, how do I pay tribute to so many people, to so many stories? And you know, I think fiction was the best way to do it because I was able to bring many people's experiences into, I could compact them into the experiences of one single family, the family, the Chan family, whose many members, you know, bore witness to many historical events of Vietnam.
How would the book have been different had it been a nonfiction or a memoir account? Does the book follow, you know, as a writer, I know too, writing novels, there's a bit of real story that's in there too, even though it may not have been completely my lived experience. How closely does the novel follow your own lived experience?
So first of all, JR, I need to express my admiration for you because you have written a memoir, Hillbilly Queer.
Yes.
You know, I don't think I would be able to write a memoir. My third book I'm working, my third novel at the moment is like very much inspired by my experience growing up, but I don't think I would be able to write a memoir because it would be too painful. Because of the many things that I went through. So I think The Mountain Scene would be very different if it were a nonfiction account, because, you know, it could be a lot longer. It could have a lot more people to tell their own stories, and it could be very complicated because, you know, Vietnamese history is very complicated. And if you want to stick to the facts, which you need to as a nonfiction book, then, you know, you have to bring in a lot of background materials, you know, and also a lot of viewpoints, because like history can be viewed via different personal experiences, and the different people may look at the same historical events differently. So my role as a writer is also to present different points of view, and it makes it very complicated.
I've listened to and read other interviews you've been involved in, including other pieces that you've contributed to talk about the writing of The Mountain Scene. There was one I read where you talked about you at the day, at the end of the day of writing, you wept all evening. And I found that to be true writing memoir as well, right? Because in some ways it's a cathartic experience going through that, but it's painful too to bring up those memories. Did you feel, even though this was a fictionalized account, there's still so much truth in history there, including your own history as well? Did you find this to be a cathartic experience to write, as they say, through this pain?
Yes, it was really painful because, I mean, you know, all Vietnamese have to bear the burden of trauma passed down, you know, from our parents. So my parents, you know, nearly died several times during the war. And I also grew up witnessing a lot of injuries and deaths, suicide, people who kill themselves because of the trauma that they inherited from the war. So, you know, that trauma is still lives in me, and it, you know, it is alive every time I write about similar events, you know. So in some way, I need to re-traumatize myself to be able to bring the trauma alive onto the pages. So, you know, and I also, you know, relive the experiences of the people whom I interviewed. So my tears, you know, were the tears that they had shed, you know, in front of me. So I carried that within me. So it's heavy, but also, you know, writing this book, I also incorporate, you know, moments of joy, a lot of celebration of the Vietnamese cuisine, culture, you know, family relations. So writing this book is a way of healing for me, I realized at the end, because when I started this book, I wanted to take revenge because I wanted to take revenge on a man who had killed my grandma. And I invented this character, Wicked Ghost, in the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to take revenge because with fiction, you can do terrible things to people. Yes, right? Yes.
You can kill people off.
Yes, and I wanted him to die a terrible death, and not just him, but his family members. Mm-hmm. But when you write a book, you discover yourself as a person. You discover your values, you know, what you want to honor as a person. And I discovered that I'm not a violent person. And in the end, I, instead of revenge, I found forgiveness instead. Mm. So you know, why? One of the reasons I wanted to use fiction for this book is that I wanted to change some of the things that happened in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was not there to save my grandpa or my grandfather, who two of whom, you know, died because of terrible things that happened during our history. But I wanted to change some of the things, you know, that happened afterwards, and to some of the people that were involved in such circumstances. So in changing some of these circumstances, I found healing for myself.
Mm-hmm. That's really beautiful. I hear you spoke about anger, and I've often heard psychologists say that anger is actually another form of sadness in how it manifests itself in different ways. And it's unhealed sadness and unhealed trauma. Do you feel like some of that anger was that unhealed trauma boiling up?
Yes, definitely. And you know, The thing with Vietnamese culture is that we, you know, the traumatized people are seen as weak, as possessed by ghosts. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're not allowed really to show, you know, your trauma or to show anger because you would lose face. You know, mm-hmm. So, you know, in our culture, it's important to keep our face, to be calm all the time. So in my second book, Dust Child, which was published, you know, in 2023, I have an American veteran who comes back to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And it was great to write in his point of view because I could swear a lot. I could use the F word, which I didn't use before in the mountains thing. But yeah. I mean, because, like, you know, it was great to you know, assume the role of this American veteran. Yeah. Also because, you know, throughout our history, Vietnamese women have been written in the voices of Vietnamese of American people. Mm-hmm. You know, so many white people have assumed our voices. So I thought, why don't I do the reverse, you know, right in the viewpoint of a white man. And it was empowering, you know. I mean, I was like, oh, I was wearing a lot. And, you know, my kids were very shocked when they read the book.
I love that. Sometimes when we write characters, I feel like it spills over into our actual lives in some ways. Were you finding yourself surprised when you were writing this American soldier's voice? Were you surprised how that manifested itself into your real life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, like when we assume as writers, when we create characters, we need to bring them to life and we live their lives in a way, we experience their experiences. So we also grow up with our characters. So mm-hmm. definitely it affected me and it helps me because this American character goes back to Vietnam with a secret that he has been, you know, keeping within himself for more than 40 years that he had a child in Vietnam. And he never revealed this secret, you know, to his wife. And they traveled to Vietnam on a holiday because she wanted him to go back to Vietnam to be healed from his PTSD. But to her shock, She discovered that he had a child there, and now he wants to look for his child. So, you know, there are a lot of conflicts in their relationship. But in writing about that conflict, you know, I also had to it made me really, I couldn't have written the viewpoint of Dan, the veteran, without my years of working with American veterans. Mm-hmm. And I have translated for them and taken them to their former battlefields, translated for their their meetings with former enemies who fought opposite them in the war. So it was really emotional. But in writing in the viewpoint of Dan, I had a look closer to the experiences of American veterans. And in the process, I became really good friends with veterans, you know, because like I felt I could understand them. And, you know, at any of my reading, if there's a veteran that comes into my reading, I feel I'm connected to them in a certain way. And in the book, I have this sentence that the war, you know, like somehow we are bound with each other together by blood, you know, because Vietnamese and Americans, we have lost so much because of this war, and it binds us together by blood.
Mm-hmm. I love the way that you have written both books, and your writing style pulls the reader right into the pages. You're a poet, right? And so your writing is lyrical. I want our listeners to get a sense of some of this if they've not read or listened to your book before. Quinn Ngo narrated your audiobook, and let's listen to her narrate the opening pages of The Mountain Sing.
Red on the White Grains. Hanoi, 1972 to 1973. Grandma is holding my hand as we walk to school. The sun is a large egg yolk peeking through a row of tin-roofed houses. The sky is as blue as my mother's favorite shirt. I wonder where my mother is. Has she found my father? I clutch my jacket's collar as the wind rips through the air, swirling up a dust cloud. Grandma bends, putting her handkerchief against my nose. My school bag dangles on her arm as she cups her palm against her face. We resume walking as soon as the dust settles. I strain my ears but hear no bird. I search, but there isn't a single flower along our path. No grass around us, just piles of broken bricks and twisted metal. Guava, be careful. Grandma pulls me away from a bomb crater. She calls me by my nickname to guard me from evil spirits she believes hover above the earth, looking for beautiful children to kidnap. She said that my real name, Hung, which means fragrance, would attract them. When you come home today, you'll get our favorite food, guava, Grandma tells me. Pho noodle soup? Happiness makes me skip a step. Yes, the bomb raids have stopped me from cooking, but it's been quiet, so let's celebrate. Before I can answer, a siren shatters our moments of peace. A female voice blares from a loudspeaker tethered to a tree. Attention citizens, attention citizens. American bombers are approaching Hanoi, 100 kilometers away. Oi, jai da doi, Grandma cries for heaven and earth. She runs, pulling me along. Streams of people pour out of their homes like ants from broken nests. Far away from the top of the Hanoi Opera House, sirens wail. Over there, Grandma rushes toward a bomb shelter dug into the roadside. She pulls up the heavy concrete lid. No room, a voice shouts out from down below. Inside the round pit just big enough for one person, a man half kneels, half stands. Muddy water rises to his chest. Grandma hurries to close the lid. She pulls me toward another shelter. Attention citizens, attention citizens. American bombers are approaching Hanoi, 60 kilometers away. Armed forces, get ready to fight back. The female voice becomes more urgent. The sirens are deafening. Shelter after shelter is full. People dart in front of us like birds with broken wings, abandoning bicycles, carts, shoulder bags. A small girl stands alone, screaming for her parents. Attention citizens, attention citizens. American bombers are approaching Hanoi, 30 kilometers away. Clumsy with fear, I trip and fall. Grandma pulls me up. She throws my school bag to the roadside, bending down for me to jump onto her back. She runs, her hands wrapping around my legs. Thundering noise approaches. Explosions ring from afar. I hold onto Grandma's shoulders with sweaty hands, burying my face in her body. Attention citizens, attention citizens. More American bombers are approaching Hanoi, 100 kilometers away. Run to the school. They won't bomb the school, Grandma shouts to a group of women lugging young children in their arms and on their backs. At 52 years of age, Grandma is strong. She dashes past the women, catching up with those ahead of us. Bounced up and down, I press my face against her long black hair that smells like my mother's. As long as I can inhale her scent, I will be safe. Hung, run with me. Grandma has squatted down in front of my school, panting. She pulls me into the schoolyard. Next to a classroom, she flings herself down a vacant shelter. As I slide down next to her, water rises to my waist, gripping me with icy hands. It's so cold. The beginning of winter. Grandma reaches up, closing the lid. She hugs me, the drum of her heart throbbing through my blood. I thank Buddha for the gift of this shelter, large enough to fit us both. I fear for my parents on the battlefields. When will they come back? Have they seen Uncle Dat, Uncle Tuan, and Uncle Sang? Explosions draw closer. The ground swings as if it were a hammock. I press my palms against my ears. Water shoots up, drenching my face and hair, blurring my eyesight. Dust and stones rain through a small crack onto my head. Sounds of anti-aircraft fire. Hanoi is fighting back. More explosions, sirens, cries, an intense burning stench. Grandma brings her hands together in front of her chest. Namu Azira Fa Namu Guante Ambodat. Torrents of prayers to Buddha pour from her lips. I close my eyes, imitating her.
In those opening scenes, I appreciate how you told the mountain seeing through the eyes of a child, Huang. In my opinion, it created a different type of empathy and understanding that couldn't have been done in the same way if it had been an adult protagonist. Talk about your decision to take the reader on this journey through the eyes of Huang.
One of the reasons I wanted to write The Mountain Sing is to have a grandmother. So both of my grandmas had died before I was born. So, you know, growing up, I was really jealous of my friends who had grandmothers to tell them stories. So I told myself, okay, one day I would write a story with a grandmother and a granddaughter so that I would have a grandma. Yeah. So that's why I created Grandma Ziu Lan and her granddaughter, Huang, for The Mountain Sing, and I had fun writing in the voice of Huang, and I realized that, you know, when Huang grew up together with the development of this book, she learned a lot. And, you know, having a child who gets to know the history, you have the opportunity for that character to be, you know, to be young, to be eager to learn, to be open-minded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this book is set in the backdrop of the Vietnam War in 1972, when Huang has to survive from American bombings. So American airplanes were bombing Hanoi, and Huang had to survive. But at that time, her grandmother brought a book of translated American literature. Mm. And in reading that book, Huang changed, you know. She hated Americans, but she fell in love with Americans after reading that book. She mm-hmm. realized their humanity. So she thought to herself, if people were willing to read each other and see into the light of other culture, there would be no war on earth.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And it goes back to the empathy idea. And children, I think, often can empathize or be more open-minded to empathy than adults. And so I love the way that you unfolded the story through Huang's experience and her motivations. It was a fantastic way that I hope other readers are drawn into to feel that same empathy that she felt in that moment. Going back to that time in Vietnam and post-war, post at least American and Vietnam War, writing was something that you were dissuaded from by your parents just based on what they had experienced in their own lifetime in the country. What gave you the motivation to keep pursuing your dream?
One of the reasons why I became a writer is that I love to read. Stories really saved me during my most difficult moments. So I kept a diary from a very young age, and I kept writing, you know, into it. So the love to read really inspired me to be a writer. And for years I worked as a volunteer translating for veterans. So when I translated their poetry, their essays, or their stories, and facilitated readings, you know, among veterans, I saw how important that work was, how life-changing it was for me. And I realized the power of storytelling. So, you know, I had no choice but to write. You know, there are stories that need to be told, you know. There are stories that refuse to sleep. And I remember when I wrote The Mountain Sing and Dust Giant, and each book took me 7 years. Mm-hmm. During the process of creating each book, there were nights that I could not sleep. I would hear my characters calling out to me, you know. They would say, get up and write. Our stories cannot sleep unless you tell them.
Mm. Wow. How do your parents feel about your writing out once you became a writer, knowing that the Vietnam they grew up in did not provide a supportive life for writers based on the government at that time? And as I mentioned before, and you've talked about in other interviews, you were a bit dissuaded, at least, to go into writing when you were younger. How do they feel about that now?
So this was a gradual process, right? In 2008, I published my book of poetry. And I didn't write anything about, you know, politics at that time. So it was very safe, I must say. Yeah. You know, in terms of Vietnamese censorship, you know, yeah. It was very safe. And, you know, I wrote about the garbage collectors or the street sellers. You know, I wanted to honor the ordinary working people of Vietnam via my poetry. Mm-hmm. My parents were really not like, they love reading my poetry. And I wrote a lot of poems about them. So recently, you know, there was a Vietnamese TV program that asked me to do a special reading for my parents because I brought them to their home villages, their birth villages. And I did a poetry reading. I cried from the beginning to the end.
Uh-huh.
Because it was my first time reading poetry in my birthplace and also a poetry reading for my family. And it was very personal. And I only read poetry that I had written for my parents. And I cried from the beginning to the end. And everyone was crying so much. So I think they could feel that, you know, what I wrote, what I've been writing is really important to me, you know. They are very curious about my two novels, which unfortunately have not been published in Vietnamese yet. They are being translated into Vietnamese, and hopefully they will be able to come out this year. So I will see. But I look forward to their reactions of the novel. I think they would be surprised because, I mean, in these two novels, I deal with very difficult parts of our Vietnamese history, you know, the parts that we have been forbidden to talk about and the parts that have been censored. I think it was a difficult decision for me to handle this history.
Mm-hmm. Does it make you nervous to have your parents read this different kind of work?
You know, I have been preparing them for this because, you know, like they live in Vietnam, right? And in Vietnam, if you only watch, you know, like TV, the national TVs, which are of government owned, and you read, the newspapers, which are also censored, you have different viewpoints of history. But so I have been preparing them for my book by buying them literature that deal with different difficult topics.
Uh-huh.
I've been buying them censored books, you know, books that are published overseas, which could not be published in Vietnam. Uh-huh. And we talk about these, and I mean, they're very open-minded, you know. My parents, they read so much, you know, they read everything. They are real bookworms. And, you know, like currently, we have had many insightful conversations about these events, and it's been just amazing because they have been able to open up to me, you know, a lot of the things that happened to them in the past that they did not talk about.
Mm. So it's been a healing journey for them too, through you, yeah, in many ways.
Definitely. I mean, a healing for all of us, because in becoming a writer, I could do a lot of research. And I think once I do have done a lot more research, I understood, you know, their personal experiences. So I could ask them more questions. And I think for any traumatized person, they have the need to share, the need to communalize the experiences. So mm-hmm. I mean, in talking with them, I think they felt understood. They felt less alone. And, you know, like whenever I'm home, I spend a lot of time with my mom, cooking with her, and have long walks with my parents in the park where we talk about things, you know. And recently we spend time, you know, traveling back to their villages. And, you know, some of the things are very difficult to talk about. For example, my father just told me just very recently that he has an uncle missing, you know, from the 40s. One of his uncle is still missing, you know, from the Great Hunger, where 2 million Vietnamese died. And we lost 3 family members at that time who died in the Great Hunger when Vietnam was occupied by the French and the Japanese. And only recently that he shared with me that he doesn't know where one of his uncles is and whether the uncle is still alive or he passed away or what happened to him, you know. He just told me recently because it was so painful for him.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting point that you're making around all of that. And it makes me think about something I read recently about you traveling with your family back to your mother's childhood home to reconstruct it, because it had been taken away from her family during the land reform in the 1950s. Going off of all that we talked about, kind of this healing and kind of rediscovering your own family in many ways through your own writing, talk about this experience of reclaiming property and the importance of place.
Mm. So, you know, the land reform is something that happened in the 50s in Vietnam. It was a movement implemented by, you know, by the communist government at that time, where, you know, farmers, where properties were taken away from the rich and divided, you know, to the poor. The policy was great, you know, like everyone should be equal, right? There should mm-hmm. be no rich and no poor, no class in society. But it went too far and there were many mistakes. So, for example, my grandfather owned a very small piece of land, but because he was sick and his wife had died, he was condemned a landlord because, you know, each village had to choose like some rich landlord to punish. Mm. And he was condemned as one of those rich landlords. So you know, they beat him up and imprisoned him and they took over the house. So my mom and her brothers had to leave the house and go and find a place to live. And my mom told me, my mom was very young at that time. And my mom said that they threw a hoe at her and say, go and hold your life, go and hold your living, you know. Mm. So, and no relatives wanted to have her at that time because, you know, they didn't want to be associated with these bad people. So it was very difficult for my mom. So, you know, like people then, you know, like farmers or were allowed to go into the house and take over the thing. So they lived there. They stole a lot of the things, and, you know, they took some part of the house with them. And when the house was returned later, you know, it was destroyed, you know. Mm. So you know, my relatives fixed it to be able to stay there. But recently, you know, we rebuilt it to the original form. So it was really emotional for me. You know, I have to tell you that my mother's eldest brother had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So we went back to visit him maybe 8 years ago, and he could not remember my mother, his own sister, nor her name. But he remembered the land reform.
Wow.
He could not remember the way home if he left the house, if he went out to the village road. But he remembered what happened to his father.
Mm-hmm.
It was so incredible. That was the only thing that was etched onto his mind that he could not forget. So it was horrible. So it was really emotional for me to return to that place. And, you know, I never met my grandparents, you know, to see their pictures on the altar, to burn incense for them, and, you know, to be there and to feel their spirit. Mm-hmm. And you know, and to feel that I need to tell their stories, you know, that their stories should not be forgotten. So it was, you know, every time I just love that house. Mm-hmm. The garden has so many trees, and all the trees are still there. And, you know, when I go back home, I feel like I'm so rich because I have so many relatives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like more than 100 people came and had dinner. You know, my cousins, you know, made a big meal. And so we all cooked and we all gathered and we all ate together. So, you know, in Vietnam, the concept of family is huge. So, you know, for example, for my wedding, I had 200 people, most of them my relatives. And, you know, my wedding took place in the city where many people couldn't get there because they live too far away. But I mean, when we are, you know, like we count so many like distant relatives as relatives. So, you know, relatives in Vietnam, like the families are really, really big.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the mountain seeing and Dust Child just for a moment, and a little bit about your childhood mixed in here, too. You learned English when you were in the eighth grade, and I know you actually started to learn English a little earlier, but your brother was a little impatient with you, and so you gave up on that a little bit, right? But in eighth grade, you started to learn English, and The Mountain Seeing is your first novel in English. Your other work is all in Vietnamese. Talk about the decision to write The Mountain Seeing and Dust Child in English versus Vietnamese.
So, you know, I grew up in Bạc Liêu, in the countryside, where there was no English teacher at my school. So I was really, when I was around at eighth grade, my brother tried to teach me English, and I was laughing at him so much that because of the pronunciation. So he was so upset, so he gave up. So luckily at that time, there was a teacher, his name is Trương Văn Anh. He came to our hometown, and he offered, you know, like free English lessons for poor kids. So I was really lucky. I had the opportunity to study with him. You know, like I love the English language taught by my teacher because he taught us English via song. So he had a guitar in class where he sang for us, and we repeated the song we sang with him. So I fell in love with the English language. And later, you know, I was very lucky to get a scholarship to Australia, and I returned to Vietnam. And I love Vietnamese poetry so much that I started, you know, to translate Vietnamese poetry to invite international readers to Vietnam via our literature, because, you know, we are known outside Vietnam mainly as the war. So, you know, and our poetry is so unique, so beautiful. So I started translating. And then I was thinking, okay, not many people read poetry these days, unless, you know, you write poetry like Ocean Vuong. Yeah. I'm one of my favorite poets. So then I was looking for a novel to translate, because I thought, okay, if I translated a novel, I could have more readers. And I was looking for that novel until one day I told myself, why don't I write this novel myself? To save myself years of translation, you know? So then I started writing The Mountain Sing. It was a crazy journey. I had to use my Vietnamese English dictionary, and I had to learn a lot. And I embarked on learning the creative writing technique. I did a master and a PhD, and I learned a lot. And, you know, like I learned a lot about decolonization through my studies. And so that's why it gave me a courage, you know, to keep my name the authentic Vietnamese way. That's why you see my name, Nguyễn Phan Quế Mai, in four words, the authentic Vietnamese way with the full tonal marks. Because like the marks, each mark is as important as the roof of a home. Right? So in Das Child, I show the importance of the Vietnamese tonal marks, because like the American veteran, then he gets to know this Vietnamese family. So he writes to them, and at first, you know, he leave out all the marks. And when he started learning Vietnamese, he realized he has been misspelling people's name. So in his letter to the family, he said, I'm sorry, Thai, your name means talented, but I have been spelling it as Thai, which means an ear. I've been calling you an ear rather than talented.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So you see the importance of Vietnamese diacritics.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, my books, you know, for sometimes readers complain that the character's name are difficult to remember. But, you know, I want to thank any reader for reading these books, because then you accept and you respect our Vietnamese culture. I don't want to change my language to please the eyes and ears of Western readers. I want to invite you to our culture, immerse yourself in our culture, and get to know the complexity and the color of our language via the books.
And with the internet, it's so easy for people, if they truly wanted to learn and they come across a word, to go to figure out how to pronounce it or how to say it. And that's part of the learning process of reading and exploring, that I hope most Americans would go on that journey and do that. Speaking of Dust Child, you focused on a different tragedy of the American and Vietnam War, Amerasian children born to Vietnamese mothers with American soldier fathers. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, how they were abandoned and ostracized by society. But why was this an important story for you to tell as a follow-up to The Mountain Sing?
You know, This story is important for me to tell because it deals with really with real life issues. At the moment, there are tens of thousands of mixed race children born into the Vietnam War who are desperately searching for their parents. A lot of them were abandoned during the war, so they grew up homeless. So that's why they were called Bụi Đời, children of the dust. So the name Das Child is inspired by that term. And you know, with the novel, I want to say that everyone deserves respect and empathy, you know. So in this novel, you will meet from a Black Amerasian, a black mixed race person who experiences extreme discrimination due to his illiteracy. He can't read and write, and because of his skin color. But you know, Phong is an artist. He's a musician. He's a farmer. He's a carpenter. And I want to highlight his humanity, also the humanity of the people, of the bad girls, or of the sex workers who had to work to serve American soldiers during the war, mm-hmm. who had, a lot of them had to give away their kids, you know. And I also want to talk about the humanity of the veterans like then, fathers of Amerasians, and the reasons why they had to turn away from their pregnant girlfriends or their mixed race children. So, you know, this book, you know, I wanted to write this book because the experiences that Amerasians went through is just horrible. But mm-hmm. there has been no book written about the Amerasians in Vietnam, as well as the comprehensive experiences of their parents. And, you know, in this novel, I have two bad girls, Chang and Quynh, mm-hmm. Who had to work in Saigon, you know, and who had to sell their bodies. And, you know, I wanted to talk about bad girls and sex workers during the Vietnam War, because hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese women had to work in these bars to entertain American soldiers. And if you watch Hollywood movies about Vietnam, you know, so many of them show these bad girls as sexual objects, as those who don't need to speak, or if they speak, they sound really like stupid, like, you know, they say very simple things. And, you know, I wanted to show these women in their full human capacity, you know, their home, their parents, why they had to go to Saigon to work as boss, and that's the struggles that they have to deal with, you know, to be able to survive during that time.
Mm-hmm. I love how in both of your works, The Mountain Singing and Dust Child, you flip the script, like you were just saying, right? You humanize people in ways that Americans have only seen it as one-sided before. That's a very empathetic approach. Would you consider yourself an empathy and peace activist? And how do those two things influence your work?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm a peace activist. You know, when I was very young, I remember I stood on the road of my village. I was looking at the bomb craters, at the people who had lost their arms and legs. And I told myself, and I really believed, and I told myself the human race would not be so stupid as to wage another war. Mm-hmm. I was so sure of that. And I was telling myself, just look at all of these things, you know, look at the bomb craters, look at these people with their eyes and limbs, you know. I was so sure that the human race would learn from the Vietnam War and there would never be another war. I was so sure. So growing up, then I learned that I'm very naive, you know, in the way that humans, you know, we use, we create excuses, you know, to wage wars onto each other. And there's also the need of people to take revenge, or, you know, there's a lot of greed and power when it comes to wars. So, you know, but I feel so helpless, you know, sometimes looking at the state of the world. But I think, you know, as much as can do, I can write to call for peace and to highlight that, you know, wars and armed conflicts, they do not just, you know, cause deaths and injuries on the battlefield. They cause destruction of culture, of nature, of families. They create trauma, which is inherited for generations to come. And I think, you know, the circle of violence only bring more hatred and more violence, you know, if this circle does not stop, I fear that the human race would end up killing ourselves. We would make ourselves extinct.
It's something that concerns me too. And I think about all of the time, and I think about what can I do to help change that world? And sometimes that's through writing, like you do as well, but sometimes that's through action. And you have put your words into action. So beyond just imagining worlds on the page, you work directly with organizations connected to the stories that you tell. Can you talk a little bit about your volunteer work, and what have you learned about yourself through being an active volunteer with these organizations?
You know, like I became a volunteer from a young age because I told the story about this teacher who gave free English classes for me when I was in the eighth grade, you know. Mm-hmm. So such an act really changed my life. So I wanted to give back. So you know, before I became a writer, I was involved already in a lot of social projects. For example, I set up, you know, like in Vietnam, we have a very high rate of childhood cancer. It's due to Agent Orange, you know, mm-hmm. a chemical that was sprayed onto Vietnam during the war. But also, you know, I think a lot of the overuse of chemicals in our food chain, and a lot of other factors. So I was once, you know, I visited a hospital with the cancer department, you know, to give gifts on the new year, and I saw the kid. They were so young and they suffered from all these horrible types of cancer. So I founded this volunteer organization to kind of mobilize, you know, help, you know. So we did, you know, free meal program. We painted the hospital walls. We you know, set up you know, libraries in the hospitals. We created, you know, play. We set up playgrounds. And, you know, like I found so many kind people. Mm-hmm. I created a walking blood bank, you know, and, you know, my group did not have any bank account. Like I did not want to gather money from people. I asked them, okay, I'm, for example, if I want to hold, you know, like a birthday party, I ask people to come and donate birthday gifts. I wanted them to be there to share not just the gift, the material gifts, but their love and their time. So we had so many volunteers, you know, so that really inspired me. So at the moment, you know, through my writings, I got to know about more about the impact of unexploded bombs. Vietnam still having people who die for, especially children, from unexploded ordnances that were dropped during the wars. You know, a lot of them were big bombs mm-hmm. that are still being discovered. And I work with this. I'm a peace ambassador of this NGO called Peace Tree Vietnam, an organization that works to remove unexploded bombs in Vietnam and plant trees on these areas.
That's amazing.
And, you know, yeah, it's an amazing organization, and it's co-founded by an American person named Geraldine Brusseau. So her brother was a pilot during the Vietnam War. So he was shot down when he was trying to rescue another pilot. So he died in Vietnam. So when, you know, so Geraldine was in Seattle at that time. And when she heard about her brother's death, she did not think about revenge or, you know, or anger towards Vietnamese people. She thought about all the mothers and all the sisters who were losing their men at that time. Mm. And she promised herself that when the war ended, she would do something to bring the two countries together. So she founded this organization, you know, and their mission is to remove unexploded bombs and to build schools and to build kindergartens and to build libraries. Wow. And you know, and it's such an amazing story. And I have been volunteering with them, and I introduced my readers to Peace Trees. So two of my readers are actually in Vietnam at the moment, you know, doing, joining Peace Tree in visiting the former battlefields of the war and planting trees with Peace Trees Vietnam. And one of the persons in Vietnam at the moment, he's very special. His name is Jay, J-A-Y. Mm-hmm. So he contacted me after reading The Mountain Sing. I introduced him to pastry, and now he's traveling for the first time to Vietnam. And Jay's father was a veteran during the war, and he was deeply traumatized. And Jay is actually retracing his father's footsteps.
Wow.
And he's in Vietnam at the moment. And it's so amazing. So he's been, you know, we've been talking since his arrival. It's so emotional. And I think this is a trip of healing for him. And I'm so glad he's doing it with Peace Tree. So Peace Tree is bringing a lot of veterans and a lot of families of you know, American veterans back to Vietnam, and you know, many of them travel there for the first time with Peace Tree. And I also am an author advocate for Room to Read. So this is an organization that aims to erase illiteracy and promote girls' education. So I'm going to have a series of events with Room to Read in Hong Kong.
That's
so
fun.
They do amazing thing to distribute, you know, books to very remote corners. So I encourage you to check out these. I have on my website, I have a webpage entitled Join Hands With Me. So I list all the organizations I volunteer with, from Peace Tree Vietnam to Room to Read to D Vance Publishing Series, where we publish books, you know, to fight against the misrepresentation of Vietnamese voices. Mm-hmm. I'm also an advisor for Stories of Vietnam. And I translate, I work as a volunteer, I translate Vietnamese children book into English, and we publish them in two languages and distribute for Vietnamese families in the US so that their children can learn the language and can appreciate Vietnamese stories and culture. Mm-hmm. I'm also an ambassador for Shelter Box Book Club. This is a UK charity book club which has raised more than £1 million to provide emergency shelters for families across the world. So, you know, like, this is one of the best book clubs that I know. And when people subscribe to that book club, they get books, and by being a member, you know, they help to provide emergency shelters. So so if you can support these organizations, I would be very, very thankful.
I love that so much, how you pour yourself not just into your writing and your novels and your poetry and all of that, but you really put your words into action to make the world a better place. As a writer, I know for myself, there are times when a book has come out and I wish I would have told parts of the story in a different way, or maybe added a little different nuance to a particular scene. But once the book's out, it's out, right? It's kind of there forever. Looking back, is there anything you would have changed about The Mountain Sing or Dust Child?
You are so right. I think that each book is never finished, you know, and as you grow and mature as a writer, you might feel the need to change some scenes or characters in your book. I think I felt that need strongly with the book that I wrote in Vietnamese. But for The Mountain Sing and Dust Child, I think I have a different feeling because I spent 7 years on each of these novels. So I edited them to death. Yeah. I remember my editor was like, we are sending the manuscript to the printer. Stop fixing things. You know, I could like debate on a comma, on a full stop. You know, I'm like, I went into such detail. So I don't think that I see a strong need to change some things, you know, but sometimes there's still misspellings. I mean, for example, you know, it's amazing, you know, like you work for so many years, hundreds of drafts on the novel, and there's still something that because you read it so often that you miss a word, you know, and it's really funny because Quyên Ngô, the narrator of of Das Jai and the Mountain Thing. When she finished narrating Das Jai, and she told me, oh, Chi, Chi means sister, she called me Chi. Chi, I saw some error, some missing, some spelling mistakes in the book. And, you know, and because she was reading it aloud, yeah. She could see it. So luckily I could, you know, send it to my publishers and ask them to fix them. Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, a book is never finished. But if I were to kind of, if I were given a chance to work on it again, I think I would need to extend my acknowledgement section because I never feel I thank people enough. I mean, you know, any book project is a result of a team's effort, you know, and I just have so many people to feel thankful to.
Yeah. Beyond novel writing, you're also an award-winning poet and filmmaker. How are these forms of storytelling different than writing novels, and how has each influenced one another?
I think writing poetry taught me about the craft of writing, because with poetry, you know, you have to work in condensing the language, in making it richer in terms of adding layers, adding images. So, I mean, it taught me a lot about writing fiction. And I must admit that, you know, I wrote fiction to cheat my readers into reading my poetry. So I enjoy sneaking, you know, poetry into my fiction. And I think the best day that I have is the day that I sit down and I wrote, you know, some poetry as part of my fiction. And I feel like, you know, I feel really happy when I can polish the words until it shines, you know, and I think that's poetry. Being for filmmaking, you know, I used to make short films, and recently I have become, a consultant for different film projects. And I worked for 2 years now as as the Vietnamese consultant on a big Hollywood project.
Yeah, oh, so exciting!
I felt really, I felt really excited about it. But I also learned that, you know, that Hollywood is very difficult to change.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know,
they weren't as open to your feedback and advice as you would hope.
So then you have to take it one step at a time, you know. So at the moment, you know, there's a team that has bought the film right for my novel Das Jai. So I wanna be involved because thank you. This team is Vietnamese American, and I want it to be Vietnamese. You know, I think I want to keep the Vietnamese essence. So the film needs to be shot in Vietnam and, you know, like authentic to Vietnam. So I think, you know, making film helps with writing in the sense that, you know, like you want to, then it teaches me about, you know, how to skip scenes, how to create suspense, how to create plot twist, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that some of the best creative writing books, are the script writing. Script writing, you know. So recently I was watching this Netflix series, Beef. Have you watched it?
No, but I've seen the preview for it, but I've not watched it yet.
Yeah, so it's, you know, the writers and then actors are mostly, the writer is Korean, American, and most of the actors are, you know, from the Asian heritage, and they did an exceptional job. And I'm like, wow, if someone were to write a book with this plot, you know, it would be an amazing book. I think, you know, the best films are the best, you know, have the best book content, you know? So I think as writers, we can learn a lot from films. And when you are involved in filmmaking, yeah, it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, writing aside, you've recently taken up running. And as a fellow runner, that brings me so much joy. I find that some of my best ideas come to me when I'm running. How has running improved your creative process?
I'm so glad that you are a runner.
I am. I can't imagine my life without it, honestly.
Yeah, at the moment, I can't either. But believe or not, I did not think I could run. I thought my knees, I had weak knees and I would destroy my knees with running. But I had to run when I was on my book tour, and because that was the only way I could keep fit. So I started running, and I'm so glad that I could take part in a race recently. And you know, like, my family is very surprised that I can run without music. Because a lot of people, they have to listen to really like powerful music when they run, mm-hmm. because it gives you like the rhythm, the motivation. For me, you know, when I run, sometimes I listen to music, but sometimes I need, you know, to think. It's a great way to think, you know. You have to keep your mind occupied. So, I mean, I must admit that I can't think about something important or difficult as plot twist, but you know, maybe something to do with a character, with a scene, I could try to work it out during the run. But I think mostly, running keeps me fresh in my mind, mm-hmm. keep me healthy. And I think we all need oxygen, yeah. in our brain. You know, like, I think we feel tired or we can't think because we don't have enough oxygen in our brain. And running really pumps our heart. Mm-hmm. It sends oxygen onto our brain. And one of the things I love doing before writing session is do a headstand. Have you tried that before?
No, I'm afraid if I tried to do a headstand, I would fall and break my neck or something.
No, it's great. It's great to do a headstand. It's like, and you know, like, you send all the blood rushing to your brain, and then you know, also another way of feeling fresh and for a good writing session is to take cold showers.
Yes.
Have you tried cold showers before?
I do. I actually end my shower every day on cold.
Oh, that's good. I mean, I have a friend who takes an ice bath every day.
Wow.
So he lives in Vietnam, and his name is Kim Lee, and he's a very well-known a Vietnamese actor and model. And he looks very young for his age and very fit. And he every day he fills this ice bath with 20 kilograms of ice.
Wow.
And he goes, and he goes into the ice bath for like 5 minutes. And can you imagine how much it hurts?
Yeah, no.
but he said it releases a chemical, a feel-good chemical that he feels happy all day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think when I take a really cold shower in the morning, I feel good throughout the day. And there's a lot of oxygen in the brain. Good for the writing.
It is good for the thought process. Somewhere out there, I know there's a teenage girl, maybe even a refugee or an immigrant, listening to this interview, and they want to be a writer to shine a light on their own lived experiences and the challenges that they've faced. What would you say to her?
We need more stories from teenage girls, from refugees, from immigrants, from those whose voices have been silenced. So please tell your story, because your voice needs to be heard.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, sometimes people get worried about that first draft. They want it to be perfect. Would you agree that keep powering through? That first draft is not great from anyone. So don't be dismayed by your own writing if you feel like it's not there. Just keep putting your voice and your story on the page.
Oh, yes. I love that advice. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, you are a great writer, so your advice is very much appreciated. And it's very helpful for me now because I'm working on the draft of my third novel.
And do you have days where you think, I'm not sure that this is going where I want it to go?
Yeah, there are days that I feel like the writing is very flat. If so, then I might take a walk. I go out in nature and I go running. Then I feel refreshed. And I think sometimes, of course, I have a word limit that I want to stick to every day. But sometimes, if I'm stuck, then I don't fear to take a break. Mm-hmm. And do something else, And then when I come back, the writing flows because I'm ready for it. Sometimes you just need to open that key, which is locked because you are too tense or because you are worried. Mm-hmm. So if you go running or if you, listen to music and sing some songs and cook, I love cooking. Mm-hmm. And, I think cooking, bring out all of your senses and then, you feel very relaxed and then you cook something nice and you eat and then you go back to your writing and you're ready to go. So sometimes a change of scenery is also very good.
Mm-hmm. The novel you're working on now or the piece of writing that you're working on now, is there any more you can tell us about that or is it too soon to share?
Yeah, sure. I'm loving this new novel. I'm currently on 70,000 paid words. And before this interview, I wanted to prepare for the interview, but I sat down and I wrote away. I was I kept typing because the words kept flowing. So I stopped writing about 10 minutes before the interview.
Oh, wow.
because today I had a really good writing day. So I, this book is also set in Vietnam, during the late 70s and the early 80s, when Vietnam was closed to foreign eyes, mm-hmm. when we were under the American trade embargo. So it is an unknown part of Vietnamese history, which is rarely told in fiction. So I want to write about it. And I wanted, I started off with a love story because I'm crazy for love stories and I want to write a beautiful love story. But it is turning into something more complex than a love story. Mm-hmm. So, normally when I write, I work on my novels, I don't know the ending.
Yeah.
So I only knew the type of characters whom I wanted to create. And then during the process of writing, the characters grow and they take me to unexpected places. And both the endings of The Mountain Sing and Das Jai really shocked me. I'm like, what? and I think it's happening with this book as well because I just figured out the ending or the supposed ending around 3 weeks ago.
Oh, fun.
It may change. And that's the exciting part because as you work on a project, you find out, you discover new things. There are writers who kind of plot out everything, who there's a detailed synopsis, mm-hmm. and that's fine. And I think they save a lot of time. There are writers who publish a book every year.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I admire them so much. I can't imagine. I write very slow because I want to craft each sentence and sneak poetry into it. And I also, because I write without knowing where the story would go. So sometimes that takes a lot of editing. It takes a lot of figuring out when. Mm-hmm. But it's fun because you discover things. So I think it's very joyful.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that. It sounds like a fantastic story. Lastly, here at the Facing Project, our work is to create a more understanding and empathetic world. I'd love for you to add your perspective on this. I've been asking all of my guests this season the same question. How do we create a more empathetic world in a time when it feels like listening and understanding the lives of others is actually decreasing?
First of all, I must thank you and the Facing Project for working towards such an important mission. to foster empathy around the world, which is much needed because our world is being destroyed by so many wars, by many conflicts, different political ideologies. So more than ever, we need to build empathy and love. It's hard to achieve, but I think empathy would be possible if there's more diversity in literature, more space for people whose voices have been ignored or brushed aside to speak up. So the world is really constantly changing and the reality is more, it's much more complex than ever before. So we need to work together to listen to each other, to embrace each other's stories and to form the circle of support and empathy for each other.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nguyen Phan Quy Mai, Vietnamese poet and novelist, author of the international bestsellers The Mountain Sing and Dust Child, thank you for joining me on the Facing Project.
Thank you so much, JR, for having me on your show. You said my name just like a Vietnamese. So thank you so much for that. Greetings and thank you to anyone who's listening to us.
Mm-hmm. More about Dr. Nguyen Phan Quy Mai and her books, essays, and films at nguyenphanquymai.com. Many thanks once again to Dr. Nguyen Phan Quy Mai for joining me on today's show, and to Dreamscape Media for providing permissions for Quinn Noh's narration of the opening scene of The Mountain Sing. To listen to past episodes of this program, visit indianapublicradio.org/thefacingproject, or find us on your favorite podcasting app, or just ask your smart speaker to play The Facing Project on NPR. To continue the conversation about this episode, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at The Facing Project. The Facing Project is recorded at Indiana Public Radio at Ball State University in beautiful and wonderful Muncie, Indiana. It is produced by the amazing producer and audio engineer extraordinaire, Sean Ashcraft. The show is distributed nationally through PRX. I'm your host, J.R. Jameson. And until next time, I wish you the courage to share your own story and the empathy to listen to others.